This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, an opportunity to talk with one of the world's foremost experts on genetic disorders and inherited diseases. Listeners, I welcome your questions for Dr. Aubrey Malunsky. Dr. Malunsky is a professor of human genetics, pediatrics, and pathology at Boston University. He is the author of many books, including How to Have the Healthiest Baby You Can and Heredity and Your Family's Health. The title of his latest book is Your Genetic Destiny, Know Your Genes, Secure Your Health, Save Your Life. Dr. Malunsky has been director of the Center for Human Genetics at Boston University since 1982. He's a believer in knowing one's family history. He says genetic disorders may threaten our lives or well-being, but our genetic destiny is not preordained. Genes, he says, are not the last word. So this afternoon, you'll hear what you can do to gain some control over your genetic destiny. Listeners, I look forward to your telephone calls. Questions and comments are invited. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Your genetic destiny, know your genes, secure your health, save your life is published by Perseus Publishing. Again, those telephone numbers 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Malunsky, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You know, over a coffee, you may hear someone talk about how both his grandmothers and his grandfathers lived long, healthy lives and were sharp and active until their deaths at a ripe old age. How reliable is such a history in predicting the health and longevity of the children and grandchildren of those grandparents?
Well, since aging is clearly not due to a single gene, but rather a combination of the interaction of genes and the way we live, the environment, it's not specifically predictive, but of course, if anything, it suggests that your chances are better to live longer if your forebears have done so. Mm-hmm. And there are indeed recognition now of one or two genes that clearly indicate some connection with aging. So I think we're still hot on the trail of genes that may enhance our longevity.
Yeah. From 1953 till today, we've learned so much about genes. What's in the foreseeable future?
Well, as you truly say, the advances have been phenomenal. Indeed, as these achievements have been as great as getting to the moon, really. And certainly their effects are going to be much more important to each of us than indeed getting to the moon. But the future, I think, certainly the next few decades, will be dominated by genetics in a variety of ways, and indeed in every field, whether it be human or agriculture or entomology or all kinds of really fields, including the pharmaceutical activities that are going on. And I think there are two, interesting directions that your listeners could anticipate. The one they've heard a lot about, and that is the pharmaceutical activities of trying to determine your genetic makeup that make you susceptible to certain disorders for which they can tailor-make certain drugs that would be responsive to your problem specifically, given your makeup, your genetic makeup. So there are huge sums of money now being spent in that direction to make those discoveries. Less well known, I think, is the direction that we're moving in, where it's going to be possible to understand and predict and ultimately intervene for a series of genetic disorders that we can detect as early as obtaining a blood sample from the umbilical cord at birth. Analysis of the DNA from those sources will ultimately show that little Johnny is susceptible to diabetes. He might be susceptible to becoming obese, have certain susceptibilities to heart disease, and so on. So you could anticipate a new breed of doctor who, beginning in the early weeks of pregnancy, will early weeks after birth, will be sitting down with mother at the first, let's say, visit after birth, 6 weeks, saying, well, today we want to talk about little Johnny's predisposition to diabetes. And these are the things we're going to pay attention to. These are the prescribed kinds of activities, the interventions, the dietary, the nutritional, and so forth. And next time they'll talk about his genetic predisposition to perhaps heart disease and so on. So that all of these advances will allow meaningful interventions over time, so that it is highly likely that our longevity will be prolonged through these kinds of new bits of knowledge and interventions. Mm.
We have a listener already waiting to talk with us, so let's go to this caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I don't know if this is a question you can answer, but in our family, two sisters have had MS. One has died. Multiple sclerosis. This is MS. The other one has a daughter who has little girls. Is there any information that we can learn about MS? Is there a genetic element to it? Can you give me any information about that?
Well, yes. It turns out that multiple sclerosis is a disorder that comes about through the interaction of multiple genes and some environmental trigger or factor that we don't yet understand. It's certainly true that it may be familial in, in that sense that we are predisposed in some way to, maybe it's an infection or some other item in the environment that precipitates this. Listeners will understand this, what we call multifactorial kind of disorder, where both genes and environment interact. When you consider somebody who perhaps lives in the Mojave Desert, never subject to any kinds of pollens until that person visits, let's say, New England during high pollen season and suddenly becomes asthmatic, now, that person had indeed the genes for asthma all that person's life until the outside trigger literally interacted with his genes or her genes to cause the clinical condition of asthma. Similar appears to be the case for multiple sclerosis, more serious, of course, involving both the nervous system as it does. So it's not a simple and clear a direct line of inheritance due to a single gene, but rather a combination.
I see, and they're not testing. Are they now testing for genes of susceptibility?
There are searches for genes that might predispose to MS, and they may be linked to genes that sit close to the cluster of genes that are involved in our susceptibility to infection, genes that make us unique in the sense of when we require a transplant, we have to be matched accordingly to those particular cluster of genes. So that's where I think we are currently.
I see.
There are indeed major advances in the treatment of MS. So I assume the two sisters are on some kind of medication already.
One is deceased.
Is deceased. The other one is in remission, but it has some slow progression.
And right.
I don't think she takes any particular medicine.
Well, she should definitely consult a neurologist because there are now medications. One of them, I think, is called Avonex, which appear to modulate and mollify this disorder and delay its progression. Avonex.
Avonex.
But they should certainly look into that.
How about the little girls? Can anything be done to find out about their future?
Well, their risks are relatively small that they would develop such a condition.
I see. All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else, toll-free, 800 1-800-222-9455. Dr. Aubrey Malunsky is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Your Genetic Destiny. He is a professor of human genetics, pediatrics, and pathology at Boston University, where he's been director of the Center for Human Genetics since 1982. The caller that we first spoke with this afternoon, our first caller, raised the issue of a family, and that is something that you really drive home in the book, Your Genetic Destiny, family history. Now, a physician often asks his or her patients for a family history, but in my experience, it's rather limited, the questions that they ask and the time that they spend on this. But you recommend putting together a thorough family history as the first step in getting a handle on your genetic destiny. What information does a thorough family history include?
Let me answer first that you put your finger right on the one of the precise reasons why I wrote Your Genetic Destiny, and that is that doctors actually don't ask any significant kind of family history, and they don't obtain a full-drawn pedigree or a family tree, which they could place right up front in the person's record and update that on an annual basis, because by doing that, they would have a very good idea of what kinds of problems are segregating within a family, and indeed provide opportunities for early diagnosis, early intervention, and indeed, more frequently than people would realize, sometimes cure of conditions like cancer. Now, the kinds of things that each of us need to note in our family tree and draw this out and keep a close watch on this year by year are instances of repeated miscarriages or stillbirths, birth defects of any sort, mental retardation, especially on mother's side, but both sides anyway, and early onset diseases of multiple types, early cancers below the age of 50, heart disease or heart attacks below the age of 50, even neurological disorders, especially early onset, all early onset conditions should get the attention of all of us. Sudden death unexplained, deafness in families, deafness and heart disease, muscle disorders. Indeed, there are some 8,600 disorders that are cataloged that are due to single individual genes, disorders or traits. So it's really important to know your history, to communicate it, and indeed it's really important that doctors do this, but that's not currently happening.
I wonder what doctors would do if patients walked in with this information. They'd probably fall over on the floor.
Well, I don't know about fall over the floor, fall over, but the sad part is that, well, I wouldn't say sad, but it's unfortunate that genetics has advanced at such a pace that it has left most practitioners way behind. Even as a geneticist today, one can spend all one's time trying to keep up with the incredible pace of advances of the discovery of new genes and their implications. Take just one example, cystic fibrosis, one of the commonest disorders among whites in the population. One in 25 people carry a defective gene for cystic fibrosis. That's a disorder with chronic lung infection, the problems with digestion, and a limited lifespan. Now, in that one gene, more than 900 different defects or mutations have already been described. So, you know, to keep up with what that means, what it means to an individual patient, what it translates to in terms of severity of the disorder, all of these, you can imagine, take both time, effort, and a huge amount of concentration to essentially synthesize this information and translate it for the use of an individual who might be at risk.
How far back or how far into the branches of the family tree do we need to go?
We need to know, I think, each of us, everything we can about obvious things like our parents and our children, as well as our uncles and aunts on both sides and our first cousins on both sides, and then, of course, the grandparents. If one is able to get a good accounting of all of those individuals, then you're in reasonable shape.
Now, we've mentioned physical illnesses and defects and early deaths. What about mental illness, depression, suicide?
Well, I think as I'm sure you've read early in the book, everything is genetic. Now, that statement initially catches some people off guard in the sense that they translate the word genetic into the inheritance. It turns out that some disorders are indeed genetic and transmissible, but others involve the genetic machinery of each cell in the body. Now, we don't know enough yet about mental illness. We do know that there's a strong genetic element, for example, in conditions like schizophrenia. But again, it's a disorder that's not due to a single gene, but rather a number of genes interacting again with outside environmental triggers. On the other hand, illnesses like bipolar, manic depression, or simply depression, we still haven't entirely figured it out in terms of how precisely these are transmitted, because they're often in families. And they're often a mix of things. Sometimes in the same family, there might be obsessive compulsive disorder and depression. Others may have mania, others simply depression, others severe enough depression to lead to suicide. At best, we think that multiple genes are involved.
Yeah. Now, given what we've just talked about, families can be reluctant to tell the truth about illnesses and disorders. And in the book, you know, you point out that families may want to shield their loved ones. They may not realize the import of such information, or they may feel ashamed, embarrassed. What counsel do you have in those circumstances?
Well, I think one has to understand how we all feel and how people feel about these particular illnesses. It's certainly no shame, and it's certainly nothing to be embarrassed about that there's a certain type of mental illness within a family. For some of these things, there's little we can do. But in a general sense, for the individual's sake and the family's sake, it's really important to be able to communicate important medical information that may have a bearing on individuals' health, on their plans for conception, future conceptions, so that they may be in a situation to decide not, for example, to have children, or if they were going to have children, to have specified tests of their genes where they're available, and also to have maybe avail themselves of the opportunity of prenatal diagnosis.
Now, if you were to hit a wall in the family, you were kind of stonewalled on this information, or perhaps you're adopted, what can someone do to do this kind of detective work to find out what their genetic makeup is?
Well, it is likely that during the century, something like a DNA or gene profile test will emerge that covers a goodly number of serious genes that cause serious disorders. But in the interim, it's rather limited, but limited also to some very important items. So in the family history story, there's a need to try and know or discover an individual's ancestry or ethnic origin, because for each of our ethnic origins, there is a what one might call a genetic burden. So, for example, just simply being white, without any history, being adopted, no idea about anything else, tells that there's a 1 in 25 risk of carrying a gene mutation for cystic fibrosis, a 1 in 10 likelihood of carrying a gene for the iron loading condition called hemochromatosis. If one was of Armenian, Arabic, Sephardic Jewish, Turkish extraction, any of those, there's something like a 1 in 8 likelihood that you carry the gene for familial Mediterranean fever, a disorder which can be ultimately quite incapacitating and ultimately lead to an early death if not caught early and treated. So for all of these particular conditions we're talking about of ethnic origin, it's when both members of a couple are carriers of the gene that they have the risk, and indeed the risk is 25%, of having an affected child. So as we go through all the various ethnic groups, there are these different disorders for which, for most of them, there are definitive tests to find out if the individual carries the gene or not.
And you note in the book that every one of us has problematic genes.
Well, when you come to realize that each of us possess somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 genes, it's no surprise that we harbor certainly a couple handfuls of, or hands full, of harmful genes. But mostly we don't know what they are unless they're specifically tested for some good reason. So they only make themselves obvious or apparent when childbearing occurs, and by sheer luck or bad luck, you have a partner who has a defect in the same gene.
Earlier in our conversation, Dr. Milonski, you mentioned environmental triggers. In fact, we've mentioned it a couple of times. Are there things in the environment that, in a general sense, we should just try and avoid, that they sort of get us into trouble, that they can trigger problematic or disadvantageous genes?
Well, let me give you perhaps a slightly opposite answer, but it's one of the best examples of an environmental factor, and that is the issue of a birth defect called spina bifida. This disorder is a common birth defect, 1 in 1,000 births or thereabouts, where there is a defect along the midline of the spine, through which the spinal cord or contents might extrude right onto the back, causing like a lump on the back. Now, then ultimately, depending upon the level of this defect, there's a lack of control and paralysis of the legs, lack of control of the bladder, as a paraplegia, and many other complications. Now, this condition is in that category we mentioned earlier of multifactorial. That is, there are both genes, multiple genes involved, and something in the environment that appears to be either a trigger, or let's call it a trigger. What we reported in 1989 and was subsequently clearly confirmed was that folic acid, one of the vitamin B complex, if taken during the planning of a pregnancy, 3 months before conception and through the first 6 weeks, one can prevent and avoid the actual development of spina bifida in 70% of cases. Now, that is surely remarkable in the sense that there's a recognized trigger, that it's can be managed, treated, and indeed, folic acid should be taken by all women throughout their reproductive period, because 50% of pregnancies are unplanned.
Right. How much folic acid should a woman of childbearing age be taking in on a daily basis?
The actual dose of the supplement is 0.4 milligrams. And indeed, it's present in all of the prescribed multivitamins. Multivitamins that are obtained by prescription,
and it's present in grains.
Yes, especially fortified.
And I know that the folks who put orange juice on the shelves at the supermarket have advertised folic acid as orange juice. Are there other natural sources of folic acid?
Well, the greens,
uh-huh.
and tomatoes, but in a general sense. It's a common experience that women simply don't take enough folic acid. And it's quite clear that the recommendation is now, it's a national recommendation, not a personal recommendation, that all women take folic acid supplements when planning a pregnancy and through the first 6 weeks. That's an absolute recommendation.
Also, though, I think we should caution that overdoing vitamins and minerals can be problematic in pregnancy as well.
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, we also published just a few years ago that excess or mega doses of vitamin A indeed cause birth defects. of various types. So more than 10,000 international units of vitamin A is a real no-no when planning a pregnancy and through the earliest weeks of pregnancy. There's no good reason to take such huge doses. This huge dose idea is based on, if some is good, then more must be better. And, of course, it's not true.
Yeah. You include a list in the book for prospective parents on how to avoid birth defects, mental retardation, and genetic disorders. Now, some are obvious. We mentioned folic acid. The guidelines involve the use of tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, illicit drugs. I think we've all gotten that message. But there are a number of other things that you list, a list of 19 checkpoints in all. What else is on that list that you would like to share with our listeners this afternoon? That's important, but perhaps less obvious than proper nutrition and avoiding drugs and alcohol.
Well, I think we've talked about some of these already, and the among the key items are, of course, the whole issue of family history and the avoidance of birth defects by knowing that family history. The preconception testing that is now available extensively all over the nation, and indeed there's no one single laboratory that provides all tests, but for example, here at the Center for Human Genetics at Boston University School of Medicine, we receive samples for DNA analysis from every state in the Union, every country in South America, and about 24 countries abroad. So genes travel, if you know what I mean. So it's possible to obtain detailed information and knowledge about specified disorders by simply sending a blood sample overnight someplace. I think we've discussed also other keys to this question. Frequently, there is a disorder that might be diagnosed in the family, and testing of other family members to determine their carrier status turns out to be a critical matter, and it's often ignored, is not referred to by the physician, and is not tracked through the family. Mm-hmm. For example, if I often see a family or a couple who have a relative with cystic fibrosis, and the first question is, well, were you tested to determine whether you carry the gene, or the gene defect? And invariably the answer is, well, nobody suggested that. Well, that's remarkable.
Hmm. Again, going back to having that family history in hand, even if you're hale and healthy and hearty.
Well, there is no one, no family that has a clean slate, so to speak.
Hmm. Dr. Aubrey Molunsky is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls. Questions and comments are invited. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Molunsky is one of the world's foremost experts on genetic disorders and inherited diseases. He is professor of human genetics, pediatrics, and pathology at Boston University, where he heads the Center for Human Genetics. He's headed that center at Boston University since 1982. He's the author of many books, including his latest, Your Genetic Destiny, Know Your Genes, Secure Your Health, Save Your Life. The book is published by Perseus. Let's take another call now from a listener in Philo on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Dr. Molunsky.
Yes, sir.
How can you suggest that samples be obtained from people and in some method sent for analysis and stored for future generations?
Good question.
I'm not sure if I understand the question is to do with storage or sending.
Both.
I wonder, caller, does this have to deal with some of the ethical and moral issues raised by testing and by storage?
No, this is technical.
Oh, okay. It's a technical question. Sorry for misunderstanding you. Okay.
Well, blood samples are simply sent at room temperature through express overnight mail and they can last actually a few days at room temperature. The white cells are removed. The genes are removed from the white blood cells, and that the genes are the DNA. And then the DNA can be kept for many, many years thereafter, in either refrigerated or frozen.
Does that answer your question, caller?
No. To what destination and where will we find recipients?
I'm not sure I understand. They could be sent to a laboratory like ours at the Center for Human Genetics. Is that the question?
Yes, sir.
So it's the Center for Human Genetics, you know, at Boston University School of Medicine.
How many centers like yours are in the country and available for sending samples to?
Well, I think there are a goodly number. Ours are among the largest, but there's certainly in the major university centers often a similar kind of laboratory doing DNA analysis.
Okay. Thank you for your call this afternoon. Now sort of to the question that I thought I heard the listener ask but was not on his mind. What happens to that information that is gleaned from these samples?
Well, these are not research activities. These are samples sent for specific diagnostic purposes to determine if someone has a condition, let's say Huntington's disease, a neurodegenerative disease of the brain, or a muscular dystrophy or cystic fibrosis, or to find out if they carry one of these particular disorders. The analyses are done and the information communicated to the patient's doctor, who usually is the one who's sending the sample.
But then the sample, it remains in storage?
It depends upon the arrangements of that laboratory. We do tend to keep these samples for many years, usually on those samples where we're looking for consent, we would ask for consent to do research on that sample. Alternatively, one can use samples of that sort in an anonymous fashion. In other words, if the analyses are done, they're done only by number, not by name. So if one wanted to find out the frequency, let's say, of a common condition, a condition that affects 5%, let's say, of the population, this is not theory, this is fact, of a disorder that predisposes a person to thrombosis, that is, clotting of blood in the veins of the legs in particular. We call that deep vein thrombosis. So if any of your listeners have ever suffered deep vein thrombosis in one leg, for example, where the danger is that a piece of clot will break off and shoot off into the lung, causing the condition of pulmonary embolism, which can threaten one's life, indeed cause sudden death, but that person should have had an analysis of a gene called factor 5 Leiden. That's Leiden like in Holland. And also another gene called the prothrombin gene. About 2% of the population carry that particular gene. So for items of that sort, it's really critical that these analyses be made and blood be sent to specific laboratories.
Because it aids in treatment and in...
Well, it's avoidance and prevention,
right?
Because if you know you're predisposed and you're taking a long trip, you might be be wise to take at least aspirin. And if you have had things like thrombosis in your leg, you might be a candidate for an anticoagulant, that is a blood thinner medication, sometimes necessary for life after this, or to avoid precipitating events, in particular the oral contraceptive, the pill.
Mm.
Women who are taking or using the pill and have factor 5 Leiden defect or prothrombin defect, that's an absolute no-no because that's a precipitant to thrombosis.
Mm.
There's a well-known Spanish study in which 30 women under the age of 30 had strokes. They were all taking oral contraceptives, and they all had one of these deficiencies.
Huh.
So anybody, any of your listeners taking the pill, and they should really be paying attention to a family history of deep vein thrombosis, because if there is such, you absolutely need to be tested.
Let's talk with another listener on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, I had a couple of questions. One had to do with a article I read recently about five companies attempting to perfect what they call single genome techniques. And what they have in mind is, unlike the national genome project, they would be able to tell you what your genome is for you yourself, you know, personally. And since you are one of the top experts in this, in having to do with this kind of thing, I was just curious if anybody, perhaps with a lot of money, had managed to get their genome read, or is that very far away in the future? And would that be like the capstone for your profession field?
Right. Can I answer that?
Sure.
You're referring, I think, to Celera, which is one of the private companies that sequenced the entire genome, and no one exactly knows whose set of genes they actually analyzed. Who was the person? Was it the CEO or a friend, a nephew, or who was it? We don't actually know, but in order for someone to get the exact and precise sequence of our entire set of genes is an enormous job, and we're a long, long way from having an ability to literally do a sequence profile of each of us. That is, that in fact took many years and tens of millions of dollars to actually achieve for essentially one person, the person on whose DNA they actually worked. So, and I think they actually worked on two or three. But so we're decades away from that kind of possibility.
Mm. Well, I guess. They're reporting on early efforts to try to do that in an economical way, like they're thinking.
Right. Oh, yes. I'm sure there'll be, you know, just like you see these executive health physicals, a very rich person might want to have their entire genome sequenced. But the issue also points in another interesting direction that you raise, and that is, who would really want to know? In the sense that there are many disorders hidden in our genes, so to speak, for which there is no intervention, no treatment, no cure. And how wise is it to go and seek an answer like that when indeed there's no remedy? So the general response today, and there is indeed a consensus about this, and the good example is Alzheimer's disease. Why go test if you can do nothing about it? And in general, the advice is not to test.
Let's talk with another listener. This one also in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering if you could tell me of the status of treatments for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, the muscle wasting disease
yes.
that usually affects young men.
Right. For the listeners' sake, this is a disorder that indeed is largely or almost completely, but not absolutely completely, confined to males. About 1 in 3,000 males born have this disorder, which becomes evident mostly around 3-4 years of age and ultimately progresses until wheelchair-bound by the age of 12. Frequently a fatal outcome by the age of 20. Unfortunately, that the advances in treatment here have not been great. An enormous amount of both money and effort has been spent in this direction, trying to even move to gene therapy to introduce a healthy gene that might remedy the deficiency of the Duchenne muscular dystrophy gene. But thus far, there has been no real success, unfortunately.
So
I've had a considerable experience with this disease because long ago, longer than I care to remember, I cared for an entire ward in England of boys with muscular dystrophy. There were about 35 or 36 boys in various stages of disintegration from this disorder. So I have a very clear and very personal knowledge of this disorder and its gravity.
If the treatment, at one point there was, as you said, gene therapy, and I believe they tested it on little used muscles of the boys. Is it understood why that therapy was not successful?
Well, I think it's the problem with gene therapy for multiple different disorders, and that is every cell in our body possesses the gene defect of that particular condition. So how does one get the remedy into every cell that's defective? That clearly is not achievable in a simple fashion. One of the remedies that have succeeded for hemophilia has been the introduction of a healthy gene making the good stuff, the good protein factor 8, the one that's missing and causes, therefore, the bleeding, by introducing it into the bone marrow as a bone marrow transplant. And in matched transplants, that has been successful. So that's one of the few beacons of light in the successful gene therapy game.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're going to go on to another caller. We've got a couple of folks waiting for us. Let's go next to a caller in Burlington on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Several years ago, my brother was very sick with flu, and then afterwards he developed adult onset diabetes. My question is, can one illness, say a virus, trigger another disorder if you're predisposed?
You didn't mention the family history. No diabetes?
My mother has diabetes.
And that was your brother who was affected?
Yes.
So how did you separate out flu from mother?
We didn't, but it seemed like it was triggered. It just came about after he'd had a very bad bout of flu. And
was that coincidence?
If it had any relationship.
Right. So, you know, of course, in an issue like this, coincidence is one matter. The other is, was he overweight?
Very slightly.
Uh-huh. Because most maturity-onset diabetes occurs in people who are indeed overweight. The vast majority occur that way.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's not completely solved yet, but it appears that for most, there's more than a single gene involved in maturity-onset diabetes. But there may be some predominant genes, and certainly there are susceptibilities, without any doubt, to say in the same cluster cluster of genes as we discussed a little earlier about multiple sclerosis, the so-called HLA cluster, which make one susceptible not only to the perhaps flu in this case, but ultimately to the diabetes. I assume that he was not young.
He was in his early 40s.
Right. So because what I think you would be interested in realizing is in the juvenile type of diabetes, not the same as your brother, but in the diabetes that strikes mostly children, even before the age of 10 or certainly before the age of 20, what is inherited is a susceptibility to viral infection, viruses like the mumps virus, the Coxsackie virus, and so on. And these viruses then get into the pancreas, into the little islands in the pancreas that make insulin. And they destroy those little islands, and therefore diabetes develops. So what's inherited is the predisposition to infection, not the diabetes.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon, and that's where we'll have to leave it today because we're out of time. Dr. Malunsky, thank you so much for spending some time with us here this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me again.
Aubrey Malunsky has been our guest this afternoon. He is the author of Your Genetic Destiny, Know Your Genes, Secure Your Health, Save Your Life. He is professor of human genetics, pediatrics, and pathology at Boston University, where he is director of the Center for Human Genetics. Again, his book, Your Genetic Destiny.